Pietism, then, was a movement for spiritual renewal within the German Lutheran churches. And it would be no exaggeration to say that it changed the face of Lutheranism for the better, according to its defenders, and for the worse, according to its critics. However, there can be no doubting its colossal impact. Among English-speaking Protestants, Pietism has gained a special interest because of its deep connections with the evangelical revival in mid-18th century Britain, particularly its strong and direct influence on John Wesley and early Wesleyan Methodism. Now, there's been much discussion on the origins of Pietism. In part, it was a reaction against Lutheran orthodoxy. Pietists felt that Lutheran orthodoxy had become too dry, lacking in practical piety, and too obsessed with condemning the errors of others. Some have seen in Pietism a symptom of a wider drive across Europe towards a more intense spirituality, also manifest as Puritanism in the Reformed world and as Jansenism in the Catholic world. However, historians have also identified some very specific positive sources of Pietism. And one of the most important sources was the Lutheran pastor and writer Johann Arndt. Now, his dates were 1553 to 1621. Arndt could be called the spiritual grandfather of Pietism. Born at Ballenstedt in Lutheran Anhalt, Arndt originally studied medicine, but ironically, illness forced him to abandon a medical career. His mind then turned to theology. In 1584, he became pastor of the church at Baderborn in Anhalt. Life became difficult, however, under Anhalt's new Prince Christian I, who was reformed rather than Lutheran. The new Calvinist regime pressured Arndt to remove religious icons from his church and drop the traditional Lutheran exorcism in the baptismal rite. But Arndt refused. Eventually, Arndt moved from Baderborn to Kvedlinburg in Lüneburg in 1599. And he ended up as superintendent from 1611 of the Lutheran churches in Brunswick's Celle region, where the Dukes of Brunswick-Lüneburg had a residential castle. Now, Arndt was a prolific author, but his most epoch-making work was True Christianity, published between 1605 and 1610 in four books. In this treatise, Arndt emphasized the transforming work of Christ in the soul of the believer. He drew on medieval writings, such as the anonymous Theologica Germanica, the works of Johann Tauler, and Thomas a Kempis's Imitation of Christ, as well as Luther himself in setting out his theme. It's often been said, rightly I think, that Arndt wanted to draw attention to Christ's life in his people as a corrective to Lutheran theology's tendency to dwell almost exclusively on Christ's death for his people. Indeed, many Orthodox Lutheran theologians condemned Arndt for allegedly betraying the central truth of justification by faith alone. Although, it must be said, that one of the greatest theologians of the period, Johann Gerhard, defended Arndt from these attacks. At any rate, Arndt's True Christianity proved a popular success. 20 editions in his lifetime. And it had a far-flung influence well beyond the boundaries of German Lutheranism. For example, it became the favourite spiritual reading of the illustrious Russian Orthodox bishop and saint, Tikhon of Zadonsk. Tikhon, in advising a young Russian noble on his religious reading, said of Arndt's True Christianity, "Always, morning and night, study the Bible and Arndt. You should only skim other books." And certainly the early Pietists regarded Arndt as their greatest inspiration. They believed they were trying to implement on a church-wide basis what Arendt had offered to the individual soul. There were also some strong Reformed or Calvinist influences on Pietism. In general, there was some degree of mingling between Lutherans and Calvinists in southwestern Germany, where the immediate father of Pietism, Philipp Jakob Spener, lived. More on him in a moment. For example, we find some instances of Lutheran sponsors at Reformed baptisms and Reformed people taking part in Lutheran services of Holy Communion. Spener was particularly impacted by several Reformed figures. One was Jean de Labadie, whose dates are 1610 to 74. Labadie was a French Catholic who had embraced the Reformed faith. Spener met him during the former's travels in 1659 to 61, while Labadie was a pastor in Geneva. Now, later on, Labadie became suspect in the eyes of Reformed Orthodoxy. He founded a community that practiced communist principles. The community's property and children were owned jointly by the whole membership. And his theology, critics felt, placed an unbalanced emphasis on the Holy Spirit's role in revealing the Bible's meaning to the individual. Spener, however, met Labadie prior to these developments. He translated into German Labadie's The Christian Practice of Prayer and Meditation, published in 1667. Another Reformed influence on Spener, the father of Pietism, was John Dury, whose dates are 1596 to 1680. Dury was Scottish by birth, but had been ordained as an Anglican clergyman, a very moderate Puritan. Dury was a member of the Westminster Assembly, where his broad views on religious toleration got him into trouble. Committed to ecumenism among Protestants, Dury spent much of his life on the continent trying to promote Lutheran Reformed unity, although few Lutherans were interested. Spener, however, said that he saw more evidence of true Christian discipleship in Dury than he saw in many Lutherans. Other Puritan influences on Spener came through literature. For instance, Lewis Bailey's The Practice of Piety, Daniel Dyke's The Mystery of Self-Deceiving, and Richard Baxter's The Necessary Teaching of the Denial of Self. These were all Puritan classics that had been translated into German. And then finally, there was some influence of mysticism on Pietism. We know that another great Pietist leader, August Hermann Francke, reprinted the spiritual guide of the Catholic mystic Miguel de Molinos, and the strange and possibly incomprehensible Lutheran mystic Jacob Boehmer also influenced the more radical Pietists. Now, let's come on to look at the life and work of the father of Pietism, Philipp Jakob Spener. His dates are 1635 to 1705. Spener was born to devout Lutheran parents at Rappoltsweiler in Alsace. At that point, Alsace was part of Germany. It would be conquered by France in 1639. After studying at various universities, including Geneva, Spener had a three-year spell in Strasbourg as a preacher without pastoral duties. Strasbourg, again, was in Germany at that point. Then in 1666, Spener became pastor of the Lutheran church in the city of Frankfurt. Here, he became disillusioned with what he felt was the spiritually dry and dead orthodoxy of the Lutheranism of his day. In his judgment, it lacked genuine living faith, especially among the clergy. It was little more, he felt, than indoctrinating people in strict Lutheran orthodoxy. Repulsed by this perceived sterility, Spener, together with a group of sympathetic pastors, argued that the cause of the deadness lay in the defective training of Lutheran clergy. He especially blamed the divorce between academic theology and spiritual life. Clergy, he said, were trained to the fingertips in book learning, but had little or no experiential knowledge of Christ and the affairs of the soul. Well, Spener and his sympathisers began meeting twice a week in Spener's study from 1670 onwards for spiritual edification. They became known as the College of Piety. Soon, non-clergy were also allowed to attend, and very radical for that day and age, even women, although it must be said the women weren't allowed to take part in discussions. The meetings opened and closed with hymn singing and prayer. They focused on promoting group spirituality through reading and discussing Christian literature. By 1674, the nickname Pietist was being applied to the group. Spener gave classic expression to his ideals in a landmark work, Pia Desideria, which could be translated Holy Desires or Pious Aspirations. It was published in 1675 as a preface to an edition of Johann Arndt's sermons, and then it was reissued in 1676 as a separate treatise. It became the spiritual manifesto of Pietism. In this treatise, Spener sets out concrete proposals for spiritual renewal within the life of the Lutheran Church, summed up under the following six heads. 1. The committed practice of Bible study by all church members, for example in small discussion groups. 2. The active involvement of the laity in the life of the church. There must be no one-man ministry. 3. An emphasis on the living practice of Christian love as more important than a mere head knowledge of doctrine. 4. An emphasis on what united Christians across denominational divides as against theological quarrels, e.g. between Lutherans and Calvinists. 5. The reform of pastoral training, so that spiritual formation of the soul and character were the main focus, not the mere transmission of scholarship. And 6. Preaching should be simple and edifying, not mere rehearsals of Lutheran orthodoxy with denunciations of all who disagree. Johann Arndt should be taken as a model of good preaching. Well, soon, Lutherans all over Germany were reading the Pia Desideria. An instant bestseller, it went through four editions over the next three decades and was translated into Latin for the international scholarly market. Some Orthodox Lutherans condemned it as having a disparaging attitude to theology, overemphasizing the religious role of emotion and being soft on Calvinists. But no less a figure than Abraham Kalov, the fire-breathing guardian of Lutheran orthodoxy, commended the book. By the close of the 17th century, Pia Desideria had unloosed a river of pietist influence that flowed not only in Germany, but in Lutheran Scandinavia, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and crossed religious barriers to find a friendly reception in Reformed Switzerland and the Dutch Republic. In 1686, Spener was appointed court preacher at Dresden in electoral Saxony at the invitation of the Saxon prince, John George III. Unfortunately, John George soon repented of his choice when Spener criticised the moral conduct of the prince's son. There was a tense standoff between preacher and prince, with Spener refusing to retract his criticism, despite intense pressure, and John George hesitating to sack him. The problem was resolved in 1691 when Spener was invited to relocate to Berlin by the Margrave of Brandenburg, Prussia, Frederick III. In 1701, Frederick transformed his lands into a kingdom, taking the title of king as Frederick I of Prussia. Now, the religious situation of Brandenburg, Prussia was highly unusual in Germany. This large, powerful state had a mostly Lutheran population, but reformed rulers, the Hohenzollerns, who had embraced Calvinism under Prince John Sigismund, who'd reigned from 1608 to 19. Unable to persuade his church to follow his example, John Sigismund had to let his people remain Lutheran. But the Calvinist Hohenzollern court in Berlin fostered the growth of the Reformed faith in other ways. For example, offering financial incentives to Calvinists to immigrate into Brandenburg, Prussia, from other parts of Europe, and giving them their own judicial system. The idea of minority communities being granted their own judicial system is nothing new. Calvinists enjoyed this privilege in Prussia. Many French Huguenots took up this offer and settled in Prussia to escape persecution in their own country, especially after the Edict of Nantes was revoked in 1685. Now, there were frictions between the two religious communities. The court sometimes had to order Lutheran and Reformed preachers to stop denouncing each other from the pulpit. Still, this unique Prussian experiment in Lutheran-Calvinist diversity survived all the tensions. Now, Prussia seems to have suited Spener, who had been so influenced by Reformed spirituality. Although he opposed the Reformed doctrine of predestination, he had a very mild attitude to the Reformed view of the Lord's Supper. Both sides agreed that Christ was present, he felt, and disagreed only about the mode. On this basis, Spener advocated Lutheran-Reformed cooperation against the common enemy, Rome. More than anything else, this made Spener abhorrent to many Orthodox Lutherans, who accused him of laxity over doctrine. The main opposition to Spener's ideals came from the University of Wittenberg, Luther's old university, whose theologians discovered no fewer than 284 heresies in Pietist teaching. In fact, Spener personally adhered to the theology of the Lutheran confessions, but he did distinguish in them between what was essential and what was non-essential. At any rate, he found a spiritual home in Prussia, with its odd combination of a largely Lutheran people under a Reformed government. Certainly the Calvinist prince, Frederick III, became a very zealous supporter, both of Spener himself and of his Pietist outlook. In Berlin, Spener was appointed rector of the St. Nicholas Church. But his greatest achievement was the creation of Halle University in 1694. Funded by Frederick III, Halle was deliberately organized as a Pietist university, where Spener's ideals would reign supreme. Spener had the perfect man to teach at Halle and set its spiritual tone, August Hermann Francke, and his dates are 1663 to 1727. A disciple of Spener, Francke was born at Lübeck, the son of a prominent local politician. He studied at several universities, ending up at Leipzig. After various adventures, including a life-changing experience of assurance of salvation in 1687, he went back to Leipzig in 1689 to give exegetical lectures. Hebrew and Greek were Franke's speciality. By now, he had identified himself closely with Pietism, and the university authorities took a violent dislike to the spiritual element in Franke's teaching. Under its impact, people were forming Bible study groups. The city fathers of Leipzig frowned on these groups as existing outside the structures of the established Lutheran church. So Franke was banned from lecturing. Spener found him temporary relief as a deacon in Erfurt in 1690, where his preaching drew a crowd. But eventually the city council expelled him, once again from hostility to his Pietism. Spener now invited Franke to settle in Prussia and teach at the new Halle University, at that point still being planned. Franke arrived during the Christmas of 1691 to 92, And to keep him gainfully employed while the university was set up, Spener had him appointed pastor of St. George Church in Glauke, near Halle. He remained in the pastorate even after taking up his responsibilities in Halle University when it was finally opened for business in 1694. So he combined the two roles of pastor and professor and did so very successfully. In the new university, he taught Greek and Oriental languages, and then from 1698 he taught theology. Alongside this, he gave practical expositions of scripture to the entire student body every Thursday morning between 10 and 11. These expositions were crucial in permeating the university with a pietist spirit. Halle would equally be a centre of academic and spiritual life and training. Apart from the Bible itself, the basic text at the heart of the university curriculum was the homilies of Macarius. The 50 homilies were traditionally attributed to Macarius of Egypt, one of the desert fathers who lived in the 4th century. Modern scholarship puts them slightly later, by an unknown author of the 5th century. A treasured part of Eastern Orthodox spirituality, the homilies were universally popular among pietists, partly because of the homilies' emphasis on the need for an experiential religion rather than a mere head knowledge. Meanwhile, Franke's work as a pastor in Glauke blossomed into a whole range of works. His area, for example, was beset with a very severe social problem, street children. In 1695, Franke set up an orphanage to care for these children and give them the necessary skills to earn a living. Within a year, Franke had to buy a house for it, so successful had this venture become. And then a year later, he had to purchase a second house. As well as reclaiming the street children, Franke established a school for poor children. The orphanage and school were soon being imitated across Germany by other pietists. Their orphanages were known as Franke foundations. In his school, Franke did not follow the traditional curriculum based on the ancient Greek and Latin classics. He devised what he believed was a curriculum that enshrined the biblical values of pietism. So rather than classical Greek and Latin, students learned biblical Greek and Hebrew. A man of unbelievable energy, Franke also set up a school to train teachers, a paedagogium. He helped found a Bible Institute in 1710, the forerunner of the Bible societies that proliferated in the 19th century. The Bible Institute printed and distributed copies of the Bible at cheap prices, some 2 million copies all told in the 18th century. It also published hymn books, prayer books and other devotional material. The financial support that enabled the Bible Institute to function came from a wealthy pietist aristocrat, Karl Hildebrand von Canstein. Now, the Prussian prince Frederick III, King Frederick I, since his elevation to monarchy in 1701, not only backed Franke's various activities, he and his successors made extensive use of those who had been trained in Halle University. So the Prussian army was flooded with pietist chaplains from Halle, imparting a quite unique spiritual flavour to Prussian military life. Halle-trained pietists were appointed to run Prussia's royal school, the Collegium Fredericianum. And then Prussia's other Protestant university at Königsberg was restructured in 1726 to conform to the pietist model at Halle. This order came direct from King Frederick William I. When in 1763 the Prussian government introduced compulsory education for all children from the ages of 5 to 13, the new public school system was modelled on Franke's ideals and practices. Now, with that level of state patronage, it's not surprising that some have spoken of pietism becoming the official state religion of Prussia. Now let's look at some other significant pietists. We've looked at Spain and Franca, basically, so far, but there were others. Let's take a sampling of them. Pietism certainly did spawn a myriad of fascinating figures, and I've just picked out a few of them here, perhaps a few of the more significant ones. And one of those was certainly Gottfried Arnold. His dates are 1666 to 1714. He was born at Annaberg in Saxony, and then studied at Wittenberg from 1685 to 89. And then he had a spell as a private tutor at Dresden, at the same time that Spener was court preacher there. The two men met. They became friends. Arnold later said that he owed his conversion to conversations with Spener in Dresden. Thereafter, Arnold's life was rather unsettled. He drifted from one job and one place to another, usually having to move on because of his outspoken disagreements with theologians and pastors, generally those of a strict Lutheran Orthodox persuasion. But he retained Spener's affection. And this was because, or rather this was despite Arnold's embrace of a much more radical, a much more extreme pietism that no longer saw any real need to work within Lutheranism for its renewal. Arnold exemplified what historians have called radical pietism as against Spener's church pietism. And the difference between them was essentially the attitude to the established Lutheran churches of Germany. Church pietists, like Spener, remained within to revitalize the church of their birth and baptism. Radical pietists, on the other hand, showed what we could call a separatist tendency. They would denounce unsatisfactory pastors as unconverted and refuse to take Holy Communion from their unworthy hands. Arnold, in fact, sometimes ended up cut off from any actual church, worshipping by himself. Spener tried to discourage those developments, but only very mildly. He was afraid of quenching the spirit if he took too hard a line. Now, it was while Arnold was in the grip of this radical pietism that he wrote his masterpiece, his Impartial History of Church and Heresy. In this massive work, published in two volumes, in 1699 and 1700, Arnold narrated church history not as the story of an institution, but as the story of the people of God, who could not be identified with any institution. After the first few centuries, according to Arnold, the institutional church was increasingly characterized by a power-mad hypocrisy. Its ultimate disaster was the conversion of Constantine, which allied the church with the powers of the world. Thereafter, Arnold found God's truth and spirit mainly in dissenting movements. These, he argued, had the true apostolic succession of spiritual life. To underline his thesis, he published editions of patristic, medieval, and 16th and 17th century mystics, who embodied for him the authentic voice of the Spirit. However, he also travelled far beyond normal Protestant boundaries. In editing the works, for example, of the Lutheran-turned-Catholic mystic, Angelus Silesius. You may possibly know him under his real German name, Johann Scheffler. He wrote the hymn, "Thee Will I Love, My Strength, My Tower," translated to English by John Wesley. Arnold also published translations of the Catholic mystics Miguel Molinos and Madame Guillon. So, as I say, well beyond the boundaries of normal Protestant piety. Now, in 1707, Arnold modified his radical pietism sufficiently to become pastor of the Lutheran parish church of Perleberg in Brandenburg, Prussia. And here he ministered for the remainder of his life. He's best remembered today for his hymns, especially among German speakers. These hymns first appeared in a volume entitled Sparks of Divine Love, 1697, often reprinted with additions. Many of Arnold's hymns were translated into English by Catherine Winkworth. Arnold's new approach to church history, there's this emphasis on the people of God, not the institution, was echoed and promoted by two other pietists. There was the jurist and philosopher Christian Timasius and the theologian Joachim Justus Breithaupt. Both men taught at Halle University after being driven out of their previous homes for their pietism. Timasius and Breithaupt saw the church in non-denominational terms as the total number of all believers throughout the world. They classed as heretics only those who rejected the utterly basic truths necessary to personal salvation. And on that basis, they were willing to regard as true believers both Calvinists and Roman Catholics. This ecumenical impulse was a key factor, enabling the easy spread of pietism across religious boundaries. English Protestants, for example, were to be deeply impacted by pietism, which seems only fitting given the huge input of English Puritanism into the making of early pietism. And that prompts us to consider another figure who illustrates, I think, this capacity of pietism to transcend denominations, namely the radical pietist Gerhard Tersteegen, who dates the 1697 to 1769. He was born in the little independent city of Moers in northern Germany and trained as a merchant in Mülheim, apprenticed to his brother-in-law. Here, at the age of 16, he experienced a spiritual awakening. And this awakening instilled into him a very profound distaste for the grubby pursuit of profit. Convinced that the life of a merchant wasn't for him any longer, Tersteegen became a ribbon maker. Now, he came to public attention through religious meetings, which had been organized in Mülheim by the reformed pietist pastor Theodor Underreich. And these had been on the go for several decades. Tersteegen was encouraged to speak at these meetings in 1725 by an admirer, the pietist William Hoffmann. In 1727, that whole area, the Duchy of Berg, was swept by a spiritual awakening. And this gave Tersteegen even more prominence at the Mülheim meetings. People flocked to Tersteegen to ask for his spiritual advice. In consequence, he abandoned his ribbon-making the following year to become a full-time counsellor of souls from his home, the Pilgrim's Hut, in Otterberg. Tersteegen represents a radical pietism that operated with scant regard for any institutional church, whether Lutheran or Reformed, although Tersteegen's roots were Reformed. His circle was a purely spiritual gathering, rooted in shared experience. The Pilgrim's Hut became the focus for a sort of unofficial, non-monastic religious community of like-minded souls. Meanwhile, Tersteegen wrote a body of intense yet tender religious poetry that has endeared itself to millions throughout the world. John Wesley translated into English some of these hymns, Thou Hidden Love of God, Lo, God is Here, Let Us Adore, and others, which have become very well-known hymns. And many of Tersteegen's other poems and hymns were translated into English by Catherine Winkworth and Frances Bevan. There was, however, significant opposition to pietism from the upholders of traditional Lutheran orthodoxy. Wittenberg University, in particular, was the stronghold of Lutheran orthodoxy and was highly critical of many aspects of pietism. But we shouldn't think that this orthodox opposition was either heartless or mindless. There really were some solid issues at stake. And maybe we can evaluate the nature of that critique in the life of Valentin Ernst Loscher. And his dates are 1673 to 1749. Born at Sondershausen, Loscher himself studied at Wittenberg University. And then he moved into central Germany. and his studies convinced him that the philosophical ideas of the French Catholic René Descartes were a grave danger to a traditional Christian worldview. Travelling widely throughout Europe, he especially spent time in the Dutch Republic, whose traditions of intellectual liberty made it the ideal place to learn all the latest fashions of thought. There, his negative assessment of Descartes was reinforced by interacting with other critics of the French philosopher. In 1696, Loscher became a lecturer back at Wittenberg, and then from 1698 to 1701, he was the superintendent of the Lutheran churches in Uterborg, and then from 1701 to 07 in Delish. 2 years of further lecturing in Wittenberg were followed by another superintendency in Dresden, the cultural capital of German Lutheranism, where he also pastored a church. Right, what about Loscher's relationship to Pietism then? He admitted that the Pietists had exposed real problems and real needs in Lutheran church life. Some of his own reforming activities as a superintendent could easily be seen as a Pietist program for reinvigorating church life. So, for example, he encouraged family devotions, pastoral home visitation, fellowship meals, generous practical care of orphans and the poor. Loscher found very little to disagree with in the original first-generation Pietism of Spener, and he defended Spener against his critics. However, he had increasing problems with Spener's disciples, and especially the radical Pietists, and that thrust him into a much more polemical attitude. He criticised what he believed was a very wrong view among many Pietists about the relationship between doctrine and spiritual life, as though the latter, spiritual life, could flourish where the former doctrine was downgraded. For Loscher, all true piety had to grow out of correct Lutheran doctrine. He defended Lutheran orthodoxy as the authentic theological expression of Lutheran belief, and he strenuously opposed any dilution of its doctrinal content, which might blur the differences between Lutheran and Reformed. Far too many Lutheran Pietists, he argued, were drifting into a fusion of Lutheranism and Calvinism, which produced a theologically boneless jelly of mere piety. He was especially concerned that a right understanding of justification by faith was being lost amid all the zeal for experience and holiness. To promote this critique of Pietism, Loscher founded in 1701 Germany's first ever theological periodical, the Unbiased News of Theological Matters Old and New. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce the German title. In a series of articles under the heading Timotheus Varinus, Loscher set out his reasons for rejecting the Pietist remedy for the church's ills. And that entire series of critical articles was then published separately in two volumes. Loscher was so eloquent in voicing his concerns that the ranks of Lutheran orthodoxy came to look on him as their chief spokesman against the massive advances that Pietism was making in their churches. On the other hand, it must be said, for all his robust critique of Pietism, Loscher didn't see it as the most urgent threat to Lutheran orthodoxy. The new philosophical thinking of the period, stemming from Descartes, the beginnings of the Enlightenment, this, he believed, was a far deadlier enemy. Now, Loscher's conviction that this godless philosophy was the real enemy inspired him to deal fraternally with Pietists as fellow Christians, in spite of their errors. He tried to bring about a rapprochement between the Orthodox Lutherans and the Pietists, drawing up a 6-point basis of discussion between the two parties. However, as is often the fate of the mediator, he was rebuffed by both sides. The Orthodox wanted to discuss not 6, but 60 points. The Pietists were offended that anyone should query their fidelity to Scripture or the Lutheran confessions even in 1 point. Despite this, Loscher did arrange a private meeting with August Hermann Francke in May 1719. Loscher thought the meeting had provided a basis for further friendly conversations. But Francke evidently had other ideas. Loscher was given a sealed letter, and when Francke opened it, he found that the message from Francke was, "You need to be born again. Only then will you be able to see that we pietists have the truth." So Loscher's attempt at orthodox pietist collaboration bit the dust. Now, it was August Hermann Francke and the pietism of Halle that first opened the floodgates of Protestant mission. And so we're going to look now at the dawn of the Protestant missionary movement. I think maybe it might be an idea to have a 15-minute comfort break before we look at this topic. So we'll reassemble at just after 5 past, going by that clock up there. And we can now move around, stretch our legs, get a drink of water or something, and then we'll look at the origins of Protestant missionary movement.